you're seeing the destruction of the Berlin Wall, the dividing line between East and West Germany. On the other side of the wall, young East Germans have rushed through the Brandenburg Gate, undeterred by water cannon fired at them by East German police. They have been pulled up on this wall by other young West Germans who have come from this side on this day when the announcement went forward that there would be no more checking from east to west and from west to east.
The fall of the Berlin Wall, the wall that was the frontier of the Cold War, that divided a city into two. I went through the wall into East Berlin way back in 1987. East Berlin was then the showcase capital of a totalitarian state, and it was easily the weirdest place I've ever been to. Gigantic avenues with just a few little Trabant cars sputtering along. There were museums still pockmarked with bullet holes that blamed the war not on Hitler, but on, quote, monopoly capitalists from the West. On the western side, the wall was covered with graffiti. On the eastern side, it was creepily and perfectly blank. 2 years after that, I returned as the wall was being joyously dismantled in that signal year of 1989, and my guest today was on the other side. His name is Michael Bobke. Michael Bobke grew up in East Germany with only a vague idea of what life was like in the West. His father was a high-ranked military officer, but his family received a terrible lesson on just how vicious that regime could be with people they regarded as enemies of the state. Michael Bobke later moved to Australia, where he began his biggest adventure of all, and we'll get to that. But first, you'll hear the story of an amazing life on the other side of the Iron Curtain. You've brought in some photos, and there's a lovely photo here of your mum and dad. And they're both in uniform. They're both very, very good looking and very Germanic looking, and they're beaming. Tell me about the photo, when this was taken.
Yeah, let me say it was taken after the World War II. My father actually served in the World War II as a young child, and later he decided to join the army. And my mom as well, she joined the army, and they both thought, okay, we just marry. And they're married in uniform. They're married on the 26th of December. So the 26th of December, nothing was open, so my dad opened it.
That's the wedding day.
That's the wedding day. That's the wedding picture.
That's the wedding picture. They're both in uniform,
exactly,
both of them.
Exactly.
And they're both soldiers in the East German state, the GDR or DDR, as you call
it
then.
Yeah, exactly.
Where were you born, Michael?
I was born a little bit outside of Berlin in a small town called Bad Saarow. That's actually not far away from another famous place that called Trebatsch. Not everyone actually knows that, but Ludwig Leichhardt.
Ludwig
Leichhardt was born in Trebatsch. And so it's a little town. There is no hospital. There's just a military hospital. So, of course, you can imagine me growing up in a family of two soldiers. I was born in a military hospital.
You were what the Americans would call an army brat.
Exactly.
A military family. So your father, was he in the Air Force?
He was in the Air Force, actually. He was pilot in the Air Force, and later he was commanded to the headquarters of the East German Air Force, and actually consulting the first German man in space, a cosmonaut.
A cosmonaut. The way you talk about him, he sounds like he was, I don't know if he's still alive or not, he's a wonderful man.
No, actually he died in 2005, and I was quite happy that I was there. It was after Christmas, and we had a long, long time to talk about all the things, questions over the years, what I still had in my mind, never answered. So I had in this time a lot of time to talk about, even to talk about his opinion about the wall in general and the falling of the wall, because he had a different opinion.
Of course. So given that he and your mum were both in the military, they would have been strong supporters of the government at the time?
Yes, of course, my dad. My dad experienced the World War II. Then the part of East Germany was taken by the Russians, and he thought really for himself that's the way how we can prevent Germany and Europe from doing another world war. So that was his way.
Many people were idealistic about communism in those days, and they felt it was a way for all people to be equal together. And were they ideologically in sync with the regime? Were they ideologically part of the regime? Did they support it ideas-wise?
Of course you had people there were quite ideological,
yes.
Thanks.
It's a big word. Yeah.
But in reality, life goes on. Some took it quite seriously. Took it so seriously that they, of course, worked for the Secret Service. It is a new way to create a society, a better society, and they just continued. But they always forgot that actually freedom was a little bit pushed aside for supporting of the system.
Of course, you wouldn't have had any awareness of any of this growing up. Your childhood was probably quite lovely, I suppose.
No, how do we say it in English? You don't know what you don't know.
So, you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly.
One day, though, your sister fell in love, your older sister. She was much older than you, wasn't she?
She was 10 years older, actually.
How did you become aware of that, and who did she fall in love with?
Actually, my sister had her first big love. And like everyone in the world, she thought, that's the man what I like, and I'd like to create a little family and just normal life like everyone. And she actually, unfortunately, fall in love with someone what my dad called bourgeoisie, coming from a middle-class family in East Germany with a lot of relationships to the West. They had a factory, they produced little buttons for clothes, and they were the main producer for East Germany for buttons. So they're quite wealthy, and my sister was a little bit attracted to that man. He was attracted to that man. And there were actually nothing wrong.
So she'd fallen in love, and they were going to get married. What was their plan?
One day, actually, they decided with some other friends to cross the border. That's a thing that's a serious offense in East Germany.
To leave East Germany?
Exactly.
To go into West Germany?
Illegally, yeah.
What do you remember of the day she told your parents that?
She didn't actually told my parents because it came back to my parents first. There were someone in the group who was infiltrated by the Secret Service to nail them. And then, of course, they were reported to the Secret Service, and it came first to my dad. And my dad was talking to her, and a day later she was picked up by the Secret Service.
One thing that's not really well known about the regime at the time was the Secret Service, the Stasi,
exactly,
had informers everywhere,
exactly,
in every aspect of life. It
exactly
was very, very dangerous to say anything to anyone.
It's the worst case can be your partner, your wife, your friend, can be informant or member of the Staatssicherheit.
What happened to your sister after she was picked up?
She came in interrogation to Halle. It's a little town, a little bit outside, not far from Berlin. And she was captured there for 18 months. And she was tortured there. I give you one example. It's one really horrible example. They had for a half an hour a walk in a backyard. And winter in Germany is quite cold. And guards in that Stasi jail, actually, they just watered them. They used cold water buckets and watered them. And they tried to break them. They tried to break them to find out what it is, what really the story is about them. And it's pure torture. If you go in minus 20 degrees, in that little jail backyard, and you be freezing down to death. Just tell that one little story. There's some much, much more.
She was pregnant at the time too.
Exactly. She was forced to an abortion.
Unbelievably cruel. What happened to the man she was planning to escape with, Michael?
That's one of the most horrible things in East German history. The people who were convicted in East Germany for crime against the law, they were actually sold out by West Germany. East Germany tried to make money out of them. So the West German government actually paid between $5,000 and $10,000 per person to get them out of East German jail and then to get them to West Germany. So he left.
They were selling prisoners.
Exactly. They were selling prisoners
to West Germany.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
The West German government was paying for them.
Yes.
But him.
Yes.
Him specifically.
Exactly.
Why would they pay for him because, and not your sister, for example?
They paid for my sister as well. But my sister was afraid, for a lot of reasons, was afraid actually it will hit my family even harder. My mother was visiting my sister in jail, and it would hit my parents even harder.
You couldn't have known any of this. You were, what, 10?
Exactly. I was, and when it started, I was 9. And I just witnessed, for a short period, a little bit trouble in our family. Really unusual. Normally, my parents are really, really quiet and not. But I know there were something, big, big discussions and tears. My sister was crying. And something went wrong in the family. But with 10, you didn't pick it up. You have no idea, no clue.
All you know is something's horribly wrong.
In a way, my parents tried to protect me, and they didn't show it really much, but I know it was something wrong, was something weird. Later, they explained to me my sister is actually leaving with her boyfriend. She's staying with them to make a family, and she's not interested to have any contact to our family.
How old were you when she returned?
I was actually, 18 months older, but in the meantime, then my father was thrown out of the Air Force.
Was that because of what
your sister? Exactly. If you have a black sheep in your family, they're always coming back and saying, comrade, what's wrong with you? How can it be that your daughter is doing that way? Why is it doing it to us? Dirtying our system, our ideology. There's something wrong with you.
But really, it's a warning, isn't it, to everyone else?
It is.
It's like,
exactly, that's
you
what
try
it is.
And escape, and we'll punish your family.
Exactly, that's what it is. Punishment for your family.
So your father then was, what, kicked out of the Air Force?
Kicked out of the Air Force. They called it for medical reasons. Mm. He was nearly 25 years in the army, so they said, okay, it's time to move on. You just have to find a new job.
So what did he do?
So he came up, he was working as in a new company, a government company, but for telecommunication. And he was a project manager of fiber optic cables.
I would have thought that would have been the, you know, the very heart of security, really, security issues.
Yeah, but, that's a little bit funny. On one side, there came the government official punishment, but on the other hand, he had a lot of friends and comrades who supported him. He said, look, we get you a new job where you can do good stuff.
Did it mean that your family then was under constant surveillance by the Stasi?
I can't answer that. Really, to be honest,
you
can't
don't know.
No, actually not, because they were quite clever, the guys. They were really quite clever. And it is not like someone is standing around the corner. It was like that, but it's not really the biggest info or most efficient information came directly from your family, can be friends. But I don't know, actually, to be honest.
When I was in Berlin at the time and then later in Prague,
I
talked to a lot of people about the secret police and what they were like, because they always fascinate me, secret police. And I had this picture in my head that they were these super smart, super efficient people. But it was pointed out to me in Prague, anyway, that the members of the secret police actually were largely what we might call, in casual term, dicks in Australia.
Yeah.
The misfits, social misfits, people without friends, rather unpleasant human beings who would normally be on the outer of any group. They were the official snitches. And that was the character of the people that were the Stasi. I mean, I don't know if you knew, you wouldn't have known any of these people, but I wonder if...
You know many people because you know them after the war came down. Some of your colleagues, some of your friends, they are not all dumb people. For different reasons. First of all, you can do quite a good career in Germany, in East Germany, if you join them. If you're dumb enough, you join them, you get lifted to better positions or whatever. You can
better make apartments.
Exactly. Yes. But also you have some people, they were forced. For instance, we do an electronic study, and we study, and in this time, people come to you and approaching you and saying, look, what do you think about the GDR? What do you think about our ideas? Would you not join us? Or some people are actually forced to it because there were some kind of made-up stories, and they're pushed into it, and then they had no choice. Victims are always victimizers, and it can be everyone. Everyone can be pushed to that position.
The effect it had was to break down trust between friends, between even family members.
They're coming up to you and saying, we find out you do something what is not regarding to our system, not regarding to our ideology. We want to that you show us, that you walk with us. Please show us. Otherwise, you be not with us. You are against us. So you have to show them what your capabilities are, and then you come with some. Michael said on the day that and that, and he was maybe planning not to refill an aircraft.
And if you've got a family and you want to do the right thing by them, then maybe you will snitch.
Exactly. That's so personal. One of my good colleagues in the army, he was interrogated by the Stasi because he was collecting little models, plastic models and cast iron aircraft models. And he was collecting them. Of course, in East Germany, you don't have many plastic models or aircraft models. So he got it from a swap mate. And one day an officer came up and said to him, "Where do you get the models from? Do you have connections to West Germany?" So he said, "No, I don't have it." And in the meantime, the Stasi started to put in his apartment, in his master bedroom, microphones. And they interrogated him and just tried to find out what's wrong with him. And after 4 weeks...
Because he had plastic airfix
exactly,
models.
Exactly, exactly. That's not... They pushed him to the wall, and then they said, "Okay, you have only two choices. You go to jail... Because we know, we have a lot of information, we have the microphones, we have the conversation, we have everything. You go to jail or you are in the group. You help us." And when I visit him after the war came down, he was bitterly, bitterly apologizing to me. And he had tears in his eyes. If you see someone, what you highly respected in the past, he was 10 years old, 12 years older than me, and he was sitting there in tears, and he apologized.
He said, what? What had he done for you?
Not really much to me, just for being a spy, and just an informant. And that's disgusting. It was really disgusting.
It's a way of life you can barely imagine. As you mentioned, your father was told to leave the armed forces.
Yeah.
And became a telecommunications person. You had to move then, didn't you?
Exactly. We moved from outside from that little headquarter of the German Air Force to Berlin, in the heart of the Cold War.
The showcase city of communist Germany, yes.
Exactly.
And what was that like? What do you remember of that? I mean, just going to this, because that was, I suppose, one of the most whiz-bang, exciting cities in the Eastern Bloc, wasn't it?
In 72, actually, or 73, we still needed some documents to go to Berlin. It was not only the war around West Berlin, there were so-called war around Berlin at all. Because they don't want that a lot of East Germans actually go to Berlin. So we had a little piece
passport
of paper.
Or
exactly.
Right. Visa. Piece of,
exactly. Yeah. To go to Berlin. Later it was abolished, it was not there anymore. But before I grew up in a small little house, it was not really special. But then I was forced in an apartment, big apartment block.
Were there more freedoms for you, though, in Berlin than there were in this little town? Or was it the other way around?
Yes, of course. First of all, I was confronted with people who had connection to the West. That's one thing. A lot of East Berliners, they still had family members in West Berlin. And when I told them I have no contact to the West, they were always laughing. They said, "What, you have no auntie, you have no uncle in West Berlin?" So it was a little bit more open than Strausberg, a little town. Yeah.
And how about the wall? Because the one thing many people don't realize about the wall, there were actually two walls. There was one wall on the western side, another wall on the eastern side, and no man's land in between.
Exactly.
On the eastern side, it's like it was white. It was blank. No one dared graffiti anything.
Because there were concrete wall. And then, of course, we had that little bit no man's land, what is actually occupied by East German army, where they actually unfortunately shoot the people or try to barricades for tanks or whatever. So on the west side, you had always access directly to a wall. That was the reason why you had paint on that side.
That's right.
If you paint it on the east side, you will be dead.
You'd be in a Stasi prison very, very quickly indeed. So what did you think it was there for, and what was on the other side?
Was not really much thinking about, but just when I passed it daily, just on the side on the eastern side, I was just looking to the other side and thought, how do they live there? How does it look like? Of course, we had West German TV.
You could see West German TV. Was that legal?
It was. My father never did it, not officially, never did it. But you could, and I did it when I went to France or whatever. We just watch German TV.
Yeah, so, just, so did you know that it was more prosperous on the other side of the wall?
Yes, of course, of course. They showed you that, but they also showed you a lot of unemployment rate. So it was not really, it was to see, and they used it for propaganda. That's what East Germans used it for propaganda. I said, look how bad it is there, so you should not go there.
There's unemployment, there's poverty.
Exactly.
And it's true, there was.
Yes, exactly.
It's true, there was. So what did you want to do after all that, Michael, for a living after that? What was your plan?
I had a hobby. I had a hobby. I was fiddling around with electronic, and I thought I'd do a kind of telecommunication mechanics or something like that. And of course, my father had a really good position, and he could bring me in that position. But of course, that's not what he had in his mind. He thought, oh, if my son is there, and let me say, in a way, I'm a little bit chaotic person. He said, just go out and find your own job. And that's what I did. I started an apprenticeship as boiler maker.
You joined the army for a while as well, and that must have become a bit of a shock, joining the army. Was it all made up for, though, by your first trip on a plane?
We have compulsory army in Germany, in East Germany. And my mother said to me, do me a favor, do not go as a border guard. That's not good. And do something what your dad did.
Yeah, you just might have to shoot and kill someone if
exactly,
you're a border guard.
Exactly. And it's in the army, of course, you're trained for it, but
you don't want to
he
live
said,
that.
No. She said, do some recent stuff, go to the Air Force. So I signed up for a long-term period in the Air Force. And I just remember the first days, you just come there and you've been shaved, checked for diseases, and then you get your uniform. And on the same night, one of the guys said, look, you are in here, you have no rights. Your rights are abolished. Army has their own rights. So if you're ever convicted to any crime, you never see a jail, you see an army jail. So I was there quite shocked, because they take your whole private life away.
And when you got on a plane?
It came 4 weeks after my first first training. You get that little, it's called Babushki Skafander.
What's that?
It's in suit, what has a lining, and it's laced. In the old days, you laced your suit to compress your body actually in that suit. So we called it Babushki Skafander. And we came up to a train up a plane, actually, what calls L-39. It's a jet fighter.
And a jet fighter?
Yes.
And you got a ride in that?
Yes, and you sit in front.
And that was the first time you'd ever been in any kind of plane?
No, I had before, because my dad was actually on an airbase.
But in a jet fighter,
yeah, exactly. Though. It's really small, I tell you, really tiny, really small. And you have a wonderful view. Especially in that thing, it's designed for training. So it's done actually that you have a good view down the runway.
You're in the big plastic canopy.
Exactly.
You can see
exactly. It's not big.
Sky.
It's not big. If you touch it, it's another approximately 500 millimeters away from your face. There's already that glass
canopy.
Canopy
is there.
Yeah.
There's a corridor between West Berlin and West Germany, because West Berlin was like a little island sitting within East Germany.
Exactly.
And there was a supply corridor.
It has
there?
To be supported. West Berlin was supported by West Germany. There were approximately 20,000 to 30,000 American troops in West Berlin. And they have to be supported. So they had a direct support line between West Berlin and Frankfurt. That's what the old Luftbrücke, the air bridge, was. And that corridor is approximately 40 kilometers wide. And you can't go off that corridor.
Because once you get out that corridor, you're in East Germany.
Exactly. And what is better than to test it? The American forces, especially guys with Hercules and a Galaxy, they always left the space just to test how quick the Germans or the Russians up in the air
to intercept. Exactly. So they're always trying to annoy you, in other words.
Exactly.
So then you'd have to go up and do what?
Normally there are two airplanes in the air permanently. That was it was in a Warsaw Pact. So it takes them, depends where they are based, approximately 5 to 15 minutes to be there. Or even if you are next to them if they're crossing your area, you're much faster there.
So how close could you get to these Hercules supply planes?
Okay, the normal procedure is quite simple. First, you do eye contact. You go next to them, approximately 50 meters away. You do eye contact. You look to them, and normally they see you. And what American forces always did, they waved their hand and said, look, we see you. But a little bit more force is when you fold out your undercarriage. You fold out your undercarriage, and that's the next. It's a really strong signal. Because what you do is that undercarriage, you're just going on top of the plane. You have a big plane. Just imagine a big plane. You're coming on top of the plane, and you can force that plane and actually to landing.
What, push it down?
You push it
with
down.
Your wheels.
You can push it down by wheels, yeah. You can.
So you're in an East German jet.
Yeah, not me. That is a procedure.
All right, that's a procedure. Yeah. But on top of a Hercules, an
exactly,
American Hercules,
exactly.
And you can push it
you
down.
You can push it down. If you're on the wrong side, yes, you can.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today you're hearing the story of Michael Bobke. He's been living in Australia for 10 years, but he grew up in what was the nation of East Germany on the other side of the Iron Curtain. His family fell foul of the authorities, as you might have heard earlier on, and his father was forced to leave the army and move to Berlin, East Berlin that was, while the wall, of course, was still in place. So time went by and you were a pilot, and then you couldn't be a pilot after a while because of a dodgy eye examination, I believe.
Yeah.
And where were you working when things was beginning to change?
After my career in the army, I was looking for a job, and my father helped me to get a job on an East German airline. That's former Lufthansa, was then Interflug.
Interflug, that's right, yes, Interflug. The East German airline.
Exactly, and then came Lufthansa again.
So that's where you were when things were starting to change in 1989?
Exactly.
The first chink in that year, as I recall, Poland had a proper election and they had a solidarity government. That was the beginning of the year.
Yeah, it was Balanza.
And then Hungary. Hungary opened the first door
okay,
to the west, didn't it?
Actually, it started already in April. In April, it was Gyula Horn, and the former foreign minister of Hungary, and he had a conversation with Gorbachev and said, look, we can't maintain our wall anymore. Our Iron Curtain is rusted away, so we have no money. And Gorby in this time, we called him always Gorby.
Gorby.
Yeah. At this time said, we're okay
with that.
Mm. Yeah, we don't force you anymore to have that wall. So the Hungarians start to dismantle their wall.
And that's when a whole lot of East Germans started going on holidays to Hungary, wasn't it?
Exactly. It came then to the time around August, July, August and summer. And a lot of Germans left actually to Hungary, and on the way, they planned to leave the country, to going to Austria.
Yeah, they go from Hungary up to Austria and into West Germany.
Exactly.
And into West Berlin, even. So were you hearing these stories? Did you know people who were doing this?
I was actually on the way to Bulgaria. And I was in Bulgaria. And when I came back, there were millions of people there, banded their car actually already, and running to the border to Austria and cross the border. Later, the Hungarian guys actually shut the border again, and that was the last fatality. The last fatality on the German wall where actually an East German shot in Hungary. Really, really dramatic scene, really horrible, actually. That was the last one. And then they closed the wall again there, and people start to flee to the German embassies, the West German embassies in Prague, in Hungary, and also East Germany didn't allow their own citizen go to Hungary, of course, you can imagine.
Now, as I recall at that time, Erich Honecker, who was
the leader
of East Germany at the time, went to Gorbachev and said, I need a bit of help from you, and he said, well, you're not going to get it. And that's when the East German state didn't become,
we had,
was no longer viable.
We had funny situation. Just think about it. We had rallies in Berlin where people were on a rally and calling for Gorby, for a communist leader.
Yes, that was very smart.
Exactly, to call for Gorby, and it just brought them in a position that they couldn't react.
They didn't know what to do.
Exactly.
There were rallies in Leipzig and Dresden and all over East Germany. And then the new leader, Egon Krenz, took over.
That was actually shortly before the wall came down.
Yes.
Because that's the German way, East German way. The leader, Erich Honecker, by himself, was not capable. He was just sick, not capable to lead the new era of communism.
So now tell me where you were on that fateful day in November when Egon Krenz, the leader of East Germany, gave a press conference and was asked whether people might actually be able to travel through the Berlin Wall. Where were you? Where did you hear the news, and how did you hear that news?
Actually, we had a I was working for that airline, East German airline Interflug, and we had a maintenance hangar, a big maintenance hangar where we had to, of course, maintain aircrafts. And we had a little old steam radio, I called it, little old radio, tube radio, and we were listening to it. And there were a press conference around 7 p.m. on the 9th of November, where one of the officials from the Communist Party introduced a new travel law for East Germans. And suddenly, by mistake, he announced something what he never heard before. So he just get a letter passed. And it was so weird. I have to try to explain it. He said from today on, from now on, every East German is allowed, without showing any reasons, to apply for a visa to travel to West Germany or to somewhere else. And some reporters asked him, what means from now? And he said, from now. So you just can imagine, East Germans took it quite seriously. Now is now.
When you heard that on the radio, what did you think?
I just thought, I said to my colleague, did you hear that? That guy doesn't know what he's talking about. We were running around and said, what means now? What is now, 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 now? And we got some informations back from taxi drivers, back from some other people. They said, the wall is open. Just tell me, what does it mean, the wall is open? Is there a hall in? Is there a gate? Is there what means open? So I was there and we were just discussing it. And we said, no, that can't be, because pressure, communist, whatever, that can't be open. There is no open. It's a mistake. It's a real pure mistake. So actually I had this day the shift were finished around 10 o'clock. And I came in front of our airport, our tarmac, and there were no taxi left. There were no taxi, no one. And people were standing there and said, look, how do we get a taxi? And there was someone standing there for 3 hours. And I said, look, I give you a lift. I'm driving to the city anyway. I give you a lift. Just pop in. And we just drove down and I picked up my girlfriend from the train station. And there were millions of people, millions of people. I thought, what's going on here? What's going on? And in this time, Richard, I was so tired. I just went home. I thought, no, it's too much for me. It's too much for me.
You went home to bed.
Exactly.
At this moment, thousands and thousands of West Berliners and East Berliners climbed on top of the wall. Here's the bit of the news report from that moment, from that night.
The police commander on duty here at Checkpoint Charlie has suddenly announced that they can go over, even though they may not have the right documents, and they're simply charging now through the small gate in the fence, where they're queuing up to get across to the western side of the Berlin Wall.
Did you go through? What happened the next day?
Yeah, next day, actually, I went back to work, what you do normally, what you try to do normally, and I just came in our hangar and nothing was happened. The half of the guys actually left already to West Germany, to West Berlin, and I was just thinking, how can we get the planes back in the air? What's the story on it? There's no one was there. Actually, some was still there. I by myself was afraid, to be honest. I was afraid to make the first step to go over there. And you don't know if the border guards will close it again, will be interrogation because you left still illegal. And I just thought, what's going on now? So I walked to 12 o'clock. Normally I have to walk to 2 o'clock, to 12 o'clock. And then I picked up my girlfriend. We went the first time to West Berlin.
What was it like to go from East Berlin to West Berlin through that crowd of mad people who were partying and drinking champagne and shouting and cheering in this bloodless revolution?
When we came to the checkpoint, I tried to explain it a little bit. First of all, there were a queue. The queue were approximately 2.5-3 kilometers long along the West Side Gallery. And, of course, we joined the queue and took us approximately an hour to come to the checkpoint. And then you got your stamp. And at this point, I have to really mention where I crossed the border. It was my famous place in Berlin. It calls the Oberbaumbrücke. It is a bridge quite well known in the movie Run, Lola, Run. It is a really, really old bridge. Destroyed in World War II, was not really rebuilt. And I was always thinking as a youngster, how does that thing looks like? How does it looks like rebuilt? And I was never, ever dreaming to cross to West Berlin, the border to West Berlin on that bridge. So when I make my first steps...
It was a dream come true.
It was a dream come true.
I can remember I got there sometime later and some days later, and there were holes in the wall. There was the former Volkspolizei, that's what they were called, the police, the border guards.
Exactly.
I'm standing there.
Yeah.
That had been so scary the first time I went there. I was standing around having a chat. I had a chat with them, Mike. And they were going, oh, yeah, well, this is interesting, isn't it? It was a fascinating time. And people couldn't wait to talk from the east side. They couldn't wait to tell you what had happened.
In this time, we had a lot of pressure in the country. There were no way. It's actually started to become chaotically, and anarchy came just in front of us. And so that release valve actually brought a lot of release to people, and there were like a big party. It is you can't describe it, actually. Enemies became friends overnight.
I was met a East German film student who took me into Potsdam, into Potsdam, which is just outside of East Berlin. And he took me to the to a former Stasi prison that had been overrun by the group Neues Forum and the Social Democrats and the Greens. They'd all just overrun this Stasi prison. I saw the Stasi prison cells as they were. You had your own role in overrunning a Stasi prison, didn't you, too?
Yeah, and on the 15th of January in 1999, we called it the Storm of the Bastille. It's still well known to East Germans. We just came to a rally, and we thought we have to rally on front of the Stasi prison. And that's the headquarter in Berlin of the Secret Police. So we knocked on a gate, on a door, and thousands of people lined up there. So the pressure was on, and they opened the gates. And we started to plunder, actually, to be plunder that whole building. Fortunately, a new forum was there and said, guys, you can't do it. We need the files. We need the files to see which crime they have done. So do not take any files.
I need to fast forward now, because you came to Australia some years later, a decade later or so. And in Australia, there you are, an electrical engineer who speaks fluent Russian, as many people were taught in East Germany. The most unbelievable job came your way once you came to Australia. Tell me how you got the best job in the world, which turned out to be the adventure of your life.
It was like a story out of a book. I just saw on ABC TV that a company in Sydney brought a space shuttle, a Russian space shuttle, to Australia. You have to know, not everyone knows, the Russian space shuttle is exactly the same size like an American space shuttle. It's built in Russia, flown once, and then the program was shut down. But the Australian company actually decided to get it on display. And I saw it on TV, and I thought, wow, I want to see that exhibition. And I was driving down to Sydney, and there were no exhibition. I just went to a maritime museum, asked them, where's the exhibition? And they said, I don't know what you're talking about, but look behind the Dalton House. There is a coverage somewhere. It looks like a space shuttle, but it's covered. It's in bits and pieces, tarps over, and yeah, there's no exhibition, but just go there. So I went there, and the gate, everything was actually covered up by camouflage. And the gate were a little bit open, and I thought, I'm coming here 1,000 kilometers from Brisbane just to, that, to see the space shuttle. I should see it a little bit more closer. So I went through that gate, and there were three guys in. And
it was all in pieces, was it?
It's all in pieces, yeah. And I asked him, do you mind that I see a little bit of that space shuttle? I just, because, yeah, it's not there. And he said, oh, yeah, just go around. Just typically Australian way. Just
wander around.
Wander around a little bit and then just disappear. And so I went up there. There were some equipment, ground equipment, like lift jacks. And I played on that lift jack. And the guy looked at me and said, do you know what's written there? It was all in Russian. He said, yeah, that's forward, backwards. And then he asked me another question. What's that written? I said, yeah, that's just the load, 350 kilograms. And then he turned around and said, Michael, can you assemble it for us? And I thought, what is he talking about? And just in, I had a half a minute time to think about it, and just came out and said, yes, of course. What do you expect?
Okay. It's like they should have put a notice on the intercom, you know, yeah. Attention all paying customers. Is there any flight engineers in the museum that speak fluent Russian that can assemble a Russian space shuttle? Oh, I can, says Michael Bobka.
So it came up to, let me say, to the story of my life. The story, really. Story
so you did
my,
it. You helped put this whole space shuttle together.
Exactly, yeah. I came a little bit later to a meeting. They called the first meeting. And the CEO this time, they put my name in front of, on a whiteboard. And they put my name up, Michael Bobka. They made a little bit a square around and then draw a line down to the crane team, to the office team, Russian team, and labor hire team. And for this moment, I was actually the project manager.
The project manager.
And
I must go down to the Maritime Museum sometime myself. Yes. I never know what kind of work you can pick up. Michael Bobka, it's been lovely having you in today and fascinating to hear your story. I don't know if anyone can probably tell, really give us such an amazing picture of what life was like in the old GDR, as it was the German Democratic Republic, before the Berlin Wall came down. It's been such a vivid picture you've been able to paint. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your amazing, amazing story. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.